University of Cambridge International Examinations. International General Certificate of Secondary Education. November Examination Series 2014. English as a Second Language. Extended Tier. Listening Comprehension. Welcome to the exam. In a moment, your teacher is going to give out the question papers. When you get your paper, fill in your name, center number, and candidate number on the front page. Do not talk to anyone during the test. If you would like the recording to be louder or quieter, tell your teacher now. The recording will not be stopped while you are doing the test. Teacher, please give out the question papers, and when all the candidates are ready to start the test, please turn the recording back on. Now you are all ready, here is the test. Look at questions 1 to 6. For each question, you will hear the situation described as it is on your exam paper. You will hear each item twice. Questions 1 to 6. For questions 1 to 6, you will hear a series of short sentences. Answer each question on the line provided. Your answers should be as brief as possible. You will hear each item twice. Question 1. What is the weather going to be like in the morning?
Here is the weather forecast for the next 24 hours. Our satellite picture shows that rain clouds are approaching from the west, so although the day will start quite sunny and bright, this won't last. At 1 p.m, the clouds will reach the coast, and we can expect heavy rain everywhere by mid-afternoon. Good news for farmers after our recent drought, but not so good for holidaymakers. Here is the weather forecast for the next 24 hours. Our satellite picture shows that rain clouds are approaching from the west, so although the day will start quite sunny and bright, this won't last. At 1 p.m, the clouds will reach the coast, and we can expect heavy rain everywhere by mid-afternoon. Good news for farmers after our recent drought, but not so good for holidaymakers.
Question 2. What does Gemma want her friend to lend her?
Hello, Gemma. Did you have a good time last night?
I certainly did. The concert was amazing. I just wish you could have come. You'd have loved it.
I'm sure I would have done. But I had to do that history homework. I hadn't written up the last essay. And then we had to do the research for today's lesson.
Oh, no! You've reminded me. I've already finished the essay, but I don't suppose you'd let me borrow your notes, would you? I'd do the same for you.
Oh, Gemma, not again.
I promise this is the last time, honest. I'll let you borrow the CD of last night's concert.
Hello, Gemma. Did you have a good time last night?
I certainly did. The concert was amazing. I just wish you could have come. You'd have loved it.
I'm sure I would have done. But I had to do that history homework. I hadn't written up the last essay. And then we had to do the research for today's lesson.
Oh, no. You've reminded me. I've already finished the essay, but I don't suppose you'd let me borrow your notes, would you? I'd do the same for you.
Oh, Gemma, not again.
I promise this is the last time, honest. I'll let you borrow the CD of last night's concert.
Question 3. A. What does the customer want to buy? B. How does the manager offer to put things right?
Are you the manager of this shop?
Yes, I'm the manager.
The service in this store is terrible. I came here for a table, but your assistant over there couldn't be bothered to stop his conversation on his mobile phone. I had to interrupt him, and even then he didn't apologise. Then he took me to the bed section and showed me a wardrobe.
Oh dear.
But that's not all. When I said that wasn't what I wanted, he turned his back on me and walked off.
I'm so sorry to hear that, sir. Let me serve you now personally. Please, come this way.
Well, all right. Are you the manager of this shop?
Yes, I'm the manager.
The service in this store is terrible. I came here for a table, but your assistant over there couldn't be bothered to stop his conversation on his mobile phone. I had to interrupt him, and even then he didn't apologise. Then he took me to the bed section and showed me a wardrobe.
Oh dear.
But that's not all. When I said that wasn't what I wanted, he turned his back on me and walked off.
I'm so sorry to hear that, sir. Let me serve you now personally. Please, come this way.
Well, all right.
Question 4. What ingredient does Jim use to decorate the biscuits?
Welcome to our programme, Kids Can Cook. Today we're making biscuits. Ready, Jim?
Yes, I've got the butter and eggs in this bowl.
Right. You just mix those ingredients.
I've done that.
OK, now add the syrup and flour and mix it up well to make a soft dough. That's it. Now cut out some small round shapes and press the blueberries into the top of each one.
They look good.
That's the idea. You could use chocolate chips or sultanas or anything colourful. Now we pop them in the oven for 10 minutes. Welcome to our programme, Kids Can Cook. Today we're making biscuits. Ready, Jim?
Yes, I've got the butter and eggs in this bowl.
Right. You just mix those ingredients.
I've done that.
OK, now add the syrup and flour and mix it up well to make a soft dough. That's it. Now cut out some small round shapes and press the blueberries into the top of each one.
They look good.
That's the idea. You could use chocolate chips or sultanas or anything colourful. Now we pop them in the oven for 10 minutes.
Question 5. What is on TV after the nature programme?
Right, Aisha. I've got the TV magazine here. Let's see what we can watch this evening. It's nearly 6 o'clock and time for the news.
Too depressing. Go on.
After that, there's a documentary called All About Crocodiles.
Not another programme about animals. Go on.
Then at 7:30, there's the quiz show that we enjoyed last week.
That's a possibility.
OK, let's have dinner and think about it. Right, Aisha. I've got the TV magazine here. Let's see what we can watch this evening. It's nearly 6 o'clock and time for the news.
Too depressing. Go on.
After that, there's a documentary called All About Crocodiles.
Not another programme about animals. Go on.
Then at 7:30, there's the quiz show that we enjoyed last week.
That's a possibility.
OK, let's have dinner and think about it.
Question 6. How will Arturo know that he has found Marie's house? Give 2 details.
I'd love to come to your house this afternoon, Marie, but I don't know how to get there from college.
It's not difficult, Arturo. I live in Fox Street, and ours is the only house with a tree outside.
And where's Fox Street?
Okay, you turn left outside the college, by the fountain. You'll walk past the town hall, then turn left again and you're in Fox Street. Our house has a yellow door. You can't miss it.
See you at 4 o'clock then. I'd love to come to your house this afternoon, Marie, but I don't know how to get there from college.
It's not difficult, Arturo. I live in Fox Street, and ours is the only house with a tree outside.
And where's Fox Street?
Okay, you turn left outside the college, by the fountain. You'll walk past the town hall, then turn left again and you're in Fox Street. Our house has a yellow door. You can't miss it.
See you at 4 o'clock then.
That is the last of questions 1 to 6. In a moment, you will hear question 7. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 7. Listen to the following interview with a scientist from Nepal about a national park and the conservation work done there. Then complete the notes below. You will hear the interview twice.
We're very fortunate to have with us today Mahav Mandal, who works for the Department of National Parks and Wildlife Conservation in Nepal. Good evening, Mr. Mandal.
Good evening.
Perhaps you could start by setting the scene and telling us a little about Nepal, as some of our listeners may not be familiar with it.
Of course. Well, we are a small but very remarkable country with an area of just under 148,000 square kilometres, and there are approximately 27 million people living here, with around 2 million Nepalese working overseas. It is between India to the south, east and west, and China to the north. We have no coastline at all. The country is extremely mountainous, and within 150 kilometres, the land rises from sea level to over 8,000 metres.
So the weather conditions must vary a lot within the country.
They certainly do. In our country, you can experience almost all the climate zones found on the planet. And in the northern part of Nepal, we have no fewer than 8 of the world's 10 tallest mountains.
Ah, yes. Nepal is perhaps most famous for its mountains, including Mount Everest, the highest point on Earth. But now, tell us about the park where you work. Let's start with its history.
It's called the Royal Chitwan National Park. Part of it was first set up as a rhinoceros sanctuary in 1960. But then, in 1973, the government declared that the whole region should be protected. In this way, it became the first national park ever established by the Nepalese government. Then, in 1984, it was included on the list of World Heritage Sites because, in those 11 years, the park had built up an excellent reputation for preserving its unique ecosystem.
So, what kind of plants grow in your park?
We have a tropical climate with an annual rainy season, so the park is rich in plant life and vegetation. The great majority of the park is covered with forests of all kinds, but we also have grasslands where you can find the 8-metre-high elephant grass. This offers shelter to animals in hot or wet weather, as well as being used by humans for the construction of walls. There are also shorter types of tough grass which the people use for thatching roofs, but there are many other kinds of grass for grazing animals.
Tell us about the wildlife in the park.
It's spectacular. There are over 450 species of birds, including the giant hornbill and different types of kingfisher. Then there are more than 43 species of mammals, all found in good numbers, such as leopards and monkeys, although lately there has been some concern about a decrease in the number of monkeys. But we are developing a good reputation for our work in protecting several endangered species, for example, striped hyenas and river dolphins.
You have had success with protecting your tigers, I hear.
Yes, we are pleased to say that the tiger population across the whole country is now 198, a rise of 63% since 2009. We are aiming to increase the population of tigers throughout Nepal by 100% before 2020, a deadline agreed by 13 countries.
How on earth do you manage to count the tigers?
We use the latest technology in the form of special cameras to identify the different tigers by their unique stripe patterns. In the future, computers will be used to record the statistics and set up data banks. We also hope to use tracking devices and satellites to track the tiger's movements.
Why is the tiger population still under threat?
Fortunately, tigers are no longer hunted for their fur, but illegal poaching is a constant threat. There can also be a conflict between the needs of tigers and the needs of humans, as they all compete for the same space. Humans want to turn the forests into farmland. However, I am pleased to say that our work in this respect is having some success.
That is indeed a reason to be hopeful.
Now you will hear the interview again.
We're very fortunate to have with us today Mahav Mandal, who works for the Department of National Parks and Wildlife Conservation in Nepal. Good evening, Mr. Mandal.
Good evening.
Perhaps you could start by setting the scene and telling us a little about Nepal, as some of our listeners may not be familiar with it.
Of course. Well, we are a small but very remarkable country with an area of just under 148,000 square kilometres, and there are approximately 27 million people living here, with around 2 million Nepalese working overseas. It is between India to the south, east and west, and China to the north. We have no coastline at all. The country is extremely mountainous, and within 150 kilometres, the land rises from sea level to over 8,000 metres.
So the weather conditions must vary a lot within the country.
They certainly do. In our country, you can experience almost all the climate zones found on the planet. And in the northern part of Nepal, we have no fewer than 8 of the world's 10 tallest mountains.
Ah, yes. Nepal is perhaps most famous for its mountains, including Mount Everest, the highest point on Earth. But now, tell us about the park where you work. Let's start with its history.
It's called the Royal Chitwan National Park. Part of it was first set up as a rhinoceros sanctuary in 1960, but then in 1973, the government declared that the whole region should be protected. In this way, it became the first national park ever established by the Nepalese government. Then in 1984, it was included on the list of World Heritage Sites because in those 11 years, the park had built up an excellent reputation for preserving its unique ecosystem.
So what kind of plants grow in your park?
We have a tropical climate with an annual rainy season, so the park is rich in plant life and vegetation. The great majority of the park is covered with forests of all kinds, but we also have grasslands where you can find the 8-metre-high elephant grass. This offers shelter to animals in hot or wet weather, as well as being used by humans for the construction of walls. There are also shorter types of tough grass which the people use for thatching roofs, but there are many other kinds of grass for grazing animals.
Tell us about the wildlife in the park.
It's spectacular. There are over 450 species of birds, including the giant hornbill and different types of kingfisher. Then there are more than 43 species of mammals, all found in good numbers, such as leopards and monkeys, although lately there has been some concern about a decrease in the number of monkeys. But we are developing a good reputation for our work in protecting several endangered species, for example, striped hyenas and river dolphins.
You have had success with protecting your tigers, I hear.
Yes, we are pleased to say that the tiger population across the whole country is now 198, a rise of 63% since 2009. We are aiming to increase the population of tigers throughout Nepal by 100% before 2020, a deadline agreed by 13 countries.
How on earth do you manage to count the tigers?
We use the latest technology in the form of special cameras to identify the different tigers by their unique stripe patterns. In the future, computers will be used to record the statistics and set up data banks. We also hope to use tracking devices and satellites to track the tiger's movements.
Why is the tiger population still under threat?
Fortunately, tigers are no longer hunted for their fur, but illegal poaching is a constant threat. There can also be a conflict between the needs of tigers and the needs of humans, as they all compete for the same space. Humans want to turn the forests into farmland. However, I am pleased to say that our work in this respect is having some success.
That is indeed a reason to be hopeful.
That is the end of question 7. In a moment, you will hear question 8. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 8. Listen to the following talk about taking books to children in Laos, then complete the following details. You will hear the talk twice.
Welcome to this evening's talk, part of our regular series about how different countries are encouraging young people to read. Our speaker is Chloe, who lives and works in Laos, in Southeast Asia.
Hello. I work for an organisation that improves the education and opportunities of young people in Laos. We have two slogans that really sum up what we try to do. First, forming futures. Second, opening minds. For me, it's the first of these that's the most important. Our work faces many challenges. Schools can be quite basic. So one of our approaches is to help local people build new or better schools, and we help to train them as teachers. Most people in Laos inhabit remote rural areas. Also, roads are often impassable during the hot, rainy season, which lasts from May until November, so transport by car or lorry is a problem for about half the year. Luckily, communication is always possible via satellite. All the problems limit what we can do. Because of the climate, construction work can only take place during the drier season, December to April. November is a particularly hectic time for us, as we are busy preparing materials and loading our trucks.
but I've come to talk to you mainly about our new project. I work with the people who live in more than 100 small villages along the banks of the Mekong River. We have set up 2 floating libraries, boats that each carry more than 1,000 books. There are no other ways of getting books, like bookshops or colleges or resource centres. Over 10,000 Lao children depend totally on these boats for access to books. Let me tell you about a typical visit of the book boat. It usually arrives in the village in the morning. The children go aboard to choose books, then sit nearby and read intently. The boat stays overnight at the village and children continue to borrow books well past dark. They have to read by candlelight because there are no electric lights or gas lamps in their homes. In the morning, the books are collected and the boat goes to the next village. The boats do not just bring books. The boat staff organise active learning games for part of the day. These games are designed to emphasise the importance and fun of reading, as well as teaching life skills, such as the importance of cleanliness and hand washing. The staff also encourage the preservation of the local culture through teaching traditional dancing and singing. There are, of course, the normal celebrations throughout the year that the children enjoy, but the book boat visits are still a highlight for them. Looking ahead, we hope to expand our programme by buying 2 more boats, if funding is available. We had hoped to find sponsors, but we haven't made much progress in that direction yet. If you are interested in helping us, you could visit our website for more information. Just go online.
Now you will hear the talk again.
Welcome to this evening's talk, part of our regular series about how different countries are encouraging young people to read. Our speaker is Chloe, who lives and works in Laos, in Southeast Asia.
Hello. I work for an organisation that improves the education and opportunities of young people in Laos. We have 2 slogans that really sum up what we try to do. First, forming futures. Second, opening minds. For me, it's the first of these that's the most important. Our work faces many challenges. Schools can be quite basic, so one of our approaches is to help local people build new or better schools, and we help to train them as teachers. Most people in Laos inhabit remote rural areas. Also, roads are often impassable during the hot, rainy season, which lasts from May until November, so transport by car or lorry is a problem for about half the year. Luckily, communication is always possible via satellite. All the problems limit what we can do. Because of the climate, construction work can only take place during the drier season, December to April. November is a particularly hectic time for us, as we are busy preparing materials and loading our trucks. But I've come to talk to you mainly about our new project. I work with the people who live in more than 100 small villages along the banks of the Mekong River. We have set up 2 floating libraries, boats that each carry more than 1,000 books. There are no other ways of getting books, like bookshops or colleges or resource centres. Over 10,000 Lao children depend totally on these boats for access to books. Let me tell you about a typical visit of the book boat. It usually arrives in the village in the morning. The children go aboard to choose books, then sit nearby and read intently. The boat stays overnight at the village and children continue to borrow books well past dark. They have to read by candlelight because there are no electric lights or gas lamps in their homes.
In the morning, the books are collected and the boat goes to the next village. The boats do not just bring books. The boat staff organise active learning games for part of the day. These games are designed to emphasise the importance and fun of reading, as well as teaching life skills, such as the importance of cleanliness and hand washing. The staff also encourage the preservation of the local culture through teaching traditional dancing and singing. There are, of course, the normal celebrations throughout the year that the children enjoy, but the book boat visits are still a highlight for them. Looking ahead, we hope to expand our programme by buying 2 more boats, if funding is available. We had hoped to find sponsors, but we haven't made much progress in that direction yet. If you are interested in helping us, you could visit our website for more information. Just go online.
You'll hear part of a radio interview with a woman who sailed round the world on her own. For questions 9 to 18, complete the sentences. You now have 45 seconds in which to look at part 2.
In the studio this week, we have Anna Stevens, who returned last July after a non-stop voyage round the world alone. Anna, welcome to the programme. Tell me, how did you get interested in sailing?
Well, although I was a teacher of sports in a school for a while, it wasn't until I started working for a travel agency that I first went sailing. A colleague invited me, and I loved it straight away. After that, I went on several sailing holidays with friends in the Mediterranean.
So where did you get the idea to sail round the world alone?
Well, I read a book, High Adventure was the title, which was about a woman sailing alone, and it really impressed me. I suddenly knew what I wanted to do with my life. So I gave up my job and talked a friend into lending me his boat. It was a bit old and rusty, but basically fine. I then spent the next few months mending the boat.
Did you take the boat out to sea to test it?
Well, that was the problem. I had planned to spend 3 weeks seeing how the boat performed at sea, but after 6 days I had to return because it got damaged in bad weather.
No.
That was good, really, because if I'd had 3 weeks of good weather, I wouldn't have realised what problems I needed to sort out.
What did people say when you had to turn back?
Oh, some of them thought this proved I wasn't ready for the trip. I would have preferred to carry on with my preparations without telling anybody, but because I relied on money from a number of local companies, they all had to be kept informed of my progress.
Right. Once you finally set out and you were out there alone, did you never feel lonely?
Well, yes, I did, but that wasn't my main problem. The trip was ruined for me by the boat making such slow progress that I got bored. I wanted to be doing something all the time. The only time I really felt busy was in the Southern Ocean, where there were enormous storms, and I had plenty to think about all the time.
Were the storms really frightening?
No, they were the really exciting part. My main difficulty was when I got back home and people didn't believe I'd really done it.
Why did that happen?
Well, as soon as I returned, I got on the phone to the World Sailing Club to say that I had successfully completed the trip and what did I have to do to get my certificate. Mm. They told me to fill in all the forms, etc. Then, on television, people began to say that it was strange, although I claimed to have sailed around the world, I'd not been in touch with any ships along the way. Ah, that's what started it. After that, the newspapers were saying I hadn't made the trip at all.
So, how did you manage to convince people?
Well, I showed the sailing club my diaries, which I've been very careful to keep up to date, throughout the trip, and they checked them and gave me a certificate. I even got an apology from the newspapers in the end.
And what will your next challenge be?
I haven't got any firm plans as yet, but I'm writing a book about the trip.
Well, thank you, Anna. We look forward to reading all about it.
Now you'll hear part two again.
In the studio this week, we have Anna Stevens, who returned last July after a non-stop voyage round the world alone. Anna, welcome to the programme. Tell me, how did you get interested in sailing?
Well, although I was a teacher of sports in a school for a while, it wasn't until I started working for a travel agency that I first went sailing. A colleague invited me, and I loved it straight away. Mm. After that, I went on several sailing holidays with friends in the Mediterranean.
So where did you get the idea to sail round the world alone?
Well, I read a book, High Adventure was the title, which was about a woman sailing alone, and it really impressed me. I suddenly knew what I wanted to do with my life. So I gave up my job and talked a friend into lending me his boat. It was a bit old and rusty, but basically fine. I then spent the next few months mending the boat.
Did you take the boat out to sea to test it?
Well, that was the problem. I had planned to spend 3 weeks seeing how the boat performed at sea, but after 6 days I had to return because it got damaged in bad weather.
Oh.
That was good, really, because if I'd had 3 weeks of good weather, I wouldn't have realised what problems I needed to sort out.
Mm. What did people say when you had to turn back?
Oh, some of them thought this proved I wasn't ready for the trip. I would have preferred to carry on with my preparations without telling anybody, but because I relied on money from a number of local companies, they all had to be kept informed of my progress.
Right. Once you finally set out and you were out there alone, did you never feel lonely?
Well, yes, I did, but that wasn't my main problem. The trip was ruined for me by the boat making such slow progress that I got bored. I wanted to be doing something all the time. Mm-hmm. The only time I really felt busy was in the Southern Ocean, where there were enormous storms, and I had plenty to think about all the time.
Mm. Were the storms really frightening?
No, they were the really exciting part. My main difficulty was when I got back home and people didn't believe I'd really done it.
Why did that happen?
Well, as soon as I returned, I got on the phone to the World Sailing Club to say that I had successfully completed the trip and what did I have to do to get my certificate. Mm. They told me to fill in all the forms, etc. Then, on television, people began to say that it was strange, although I claimed to have sailed around the world, I'd not been in touch with any ships along the way. Well, that's what started it. After that, the newspapers were saying I hadn't made the trip at all.
So, how did you manage to convince people?
Well, I showed the sailing club my diaries, which I've been very careful to keep up to date, throughout the trip, and they checked them and gave me a certificate. I even got an apology from the newspapers in the end.
And what will your next challenge be?
I haven't got any firm plans as yet, but I'm writing a book about the trip.
Well, thank you, Anna. We look forward to reading all about it.
That's the end of part two. Now turn to part three. You'll hear five young people talking about what makes a good teacher. For questions 19 to 23, choose from the list A to F which of the opinions each speaker expresses. Use the letters only once. There is one extra letter which you do not need to use. You now have 30 seconds in which to look at part three. Speaker 1.
Well, I've had lots of teachers who really knew their stuff. I mean, you could ask any question and you knew you'd get the answer. But most teachers, well, when their class was over, well, that was it. They were gone. You see, a teacher may know a lot. The thing is, it's usually after class that you need their help, often as an individual, if you know what I mean. Well, they think if they just turn up and do the job, that's good enough. I remember one teacher, she was new, said drop in any time. I like that, I really did.
Speaker 2.
I was always good at maths, and I think it was because I had this excellent teacher. I was lucky, really. I didn't like doing my homework, and he'd say, these are the rules, take it or leave it. You do this for tomorrow, or you're out of my class. You see, a teacher may be there for you whenever you need his advice, but if he doesn't force you to do your best, it'll all be wasted, won't it? This teacher had been in the school for many, many years, and I know some of the younger teachers didn't like his methods.
Speaker 3.
I think it takes some time for a teacher to become really good. Sometimes a teacher is just starting. Well, they can be so demanding, expect a lot. It's as if they want to teach you everything now, if you know what I mean. Some of my friends were always against the teachers who'd been there for a while, and I used to say, well, they're the ones who've gone through all this before, and when they tell me I've done something really well, it means a lot, doesn't it?
Speaker 4.
In my opinion, a good teacher has to be able to cover a topic thoroughly. I once had a history teacher who was really kind and helpful. You know, her smile, her manner. Like a big sister, she was. I was very interested in history at the time, and I realised she didn't exactly master the subject. I think this kind of put me off. Although she was always willing to look things up for me in her library, nothing was too much trouble for her, but I sort of lost confidence in her.
Speaker 5.
No matter how much a teacher knows about a subject, I think he or she needs to remember that the students are not there to become experts. A good teacher is one that gives encouragement all the time, who tells you when you're making progress, even if it's only very little progress. Of course, a person can know everything about a subject and still be no good as a teacher. We've all had teachers like that. The kind who'll only be satisfied with the highest standards and who will never give you credit for having tried.
Now you'll hear part 3 again. Speaker 1.
Well, I've had lots of teachers who really knew their stuff. I mean, you could ask any question and you knew you'd get the answer. But most teachers, well, when their class was over, well, that was it. They were gone. You see, a teacher may know a lot. The thing is, it's usually after class that you need their help, often as an individual, if you know what I mean. Well, they think if they just turn up and do the job, that's good enough. I remember one teacher, she was new, said drop in any time. I like that, I really did.
Speaker 2.
I was always good at maths, and I think it was because I had this excellent teacher. I was lucky, really. I didn't like doing my homework, and he'd say, these are the rules, take it or leave it. You do this for tomorrow, or you're out of my class. You see, a teacher may be there for you whenever you need his advice, but if he doesn't force you to do your best, it'll all be wasted, won't it? This teacher had been in the school for many, many years, and I know some of the younger teachers didn't like his methods.
Speaker 3.
I think it takes some time for a teacher to become really good. Sometimes a teacher is just starting. Well, they can be so demanding, expect a lot. It's as if they want to teach you everything now, if you know what I mean. Some of my friends were always against the teachers who'd been there for a while, and I used to say, well, they're the ones who've gone through all this before, and when they tell me I've done something really well, it means a lot, doesn't it?
Speaker 4.
In my opinion, a good teacher has to be able to cover a topic thoroughly. I once had a history teacher who was really kind and helpful. You know, her smile, her manner. Like a big sister she was. I was very interested in history at the time, and I realised she didn't exactly master the subject. I think this kind of put me off. Although she was always willing to look things up for me in her library, well, nothing was too much trouble for her, but I sort of lost confidence in her.
Speaker 5.
No matter how much a teacher knows about a subject, I think he or she needs to remember that the students are not there to become experts. A good teacher is one that gives encouragement all the time, who tells you when you're making progress, even if it's only very little progress. Of course, a person can know everything about a subject and still be no good as a teacher. We've all had teachers like that. The kind who'll only be satisfied with the highest standards and who will never give you credit for having tried.
That's the end of part 3. Now turn to part 4. You'll hear a radio interview about a mountain climbing weekend. For questions 24 to 30, choose the best answer, A, B or C. You now have 1 minute in which to look at part 4.
My guest today is Douglas Turner, who recently spent a weekend climbing a mountain in Africa. Douglas, how did this come about?
Well, I suppose it started with seeing adverts for activity holidays in the national press week after week. It somehow got into my subconscious. Then there was one which said, "Are you ready for the greatest physical challenge of your life? 5,000 metres, one weekend." And, somewhat against my better judgment, I found myself picking up the phone straight away. You see, I simply hadn't trained for it. The nearest I'd got was a bit of hill walking 5 years ago.
What did you think you would get out of the weekend?
Generally, when I go to things, I enjoy meeting people, but in this case, I was afraid the rest of the group would be a bunch of healthy types, and I wouldn't have much in common with them. And as for the physical effort of climbing the mountain, I thought I'd be lucky if I survived the weekend at all. It was more a kind of wanted to see what I was mentally capable of doing. Would I get cold feet and not go at all, or go but give up halfway up, that sort of thing.
But you made it to the top.
Yes, I did. Much to my surprise, I can tell you.
And were you right about the other people?
No, actually. There were a few serious walkers and climbers, but most of the participants were professional people who wanted to do something quite different once in a while. More or less like me, in fact. So, not intimidating after all. Though I have to admit that nearly all of them were fitter than me. Actually, I hadn't realised so many people did this sort of thing. It was funny, when I told a friend that I was going, she said, "Oh, not another one. Everyone I know is going climbing this year. There's a big thing about pushing yourself to your limit at the moment, isn't there?" "You're welcome to it," she said. "You won't catch me up there."
How did you all get on together?
Well, I suppose we were a bit suspicious of each other at first, but that soon went, and we somehow developed a really close group feeling, and nobody complained about having to wait for the slow ones, which usually included me. Or at least if they did complain, they did it out of earshot. In fact, on the flight home, we were busy exchanging cards and decided to book another weekend trip as a party, but without a mountain in sight this time.
So how did the weekend compare with your expectations?
It was much better than I'd expected. It made me change in subtle ways. As I'd hoped, I gained in self-knowledge and I learnt to get on with people I couldn't escape from. But I also became much more observant of the tiny little wild flowers, for instance. And that was quite a bonus.
Mm. I suppose you're going to be a regular mountain climber now.
The pair of boots I wore, I'm keeping with the mud still on them, on my desk at work. They're a kind of trophy to prove to myself that I've done it. But I somehow don't think I'll be using them again. I'm going to have to put them somewhere less visible, though, because it's sometimes a bit embarrassing when other people are impressed.
Douglas Turner, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now you'll hear part four again.
My guest today is Douglas Turner, who recently spent a weekend climbing a mountain in Africa. Douglas, how did this come about?
Well, I suppose it started with seeing adverts for activity holidays in the national press week after week. It somehow got into my subconscious. Then there was one which said, "Are you ready for the greatest physical challenge of your life? 5,000 metres... one weekend." And somewhat against my better judgment, I found myself picking up the phone straight away. You see, I simply hadn't trained for it. The nearest I'd got was a bit of hill walking 5 years ago.
What did you think you would get out of the weekend?
Generally, when I go to things, I enjoy meeting people, but in this case, I was afraid the rest of the group would be a bunch of healthy types, and I wouldn't have much in common with them. And as for the physical effort of climbing the mountain, I thought I'd be lucky if I survived the weekend at all. It was more a kind of wanting to see what I was mentally capable of doing. Would I get cold feet and not go at all, or go but give up halfway up, that sort of thing.
But you made it to the top.
Yes, I did. Much to my surprise, I can tell you.
And were you right about the other people?
No, actually. There were a few serious walkers and climbers, but most of the participants were professional people who wanted to do something quite different once in a while. More or less like me, in fact. So, not intimidating after all. Though I have to admit that nearly all of them were fitter than me. Actually, I hadn't realised so many people did this sort of thing. It was funny, when I told a friend that I was going, she said, "Oh, not another one. Everyone I know is going climbing this year. There's a big thing about pushing yourself to your limit at the moment, isn't there?" "You're welcome to it," she said. "You won't catch me up there."
How did you all get on together?
Well, I suppose we were a bit suspicious of each other at first, but that soon went, and we somehow developed a really close group feeling, and nobody complained about having to wait for the slow ones, which usually included me. Or at least if they did complain, they did it out of earshot. In fact, on the flight home, we were busy exchanging cards and decided to book another weekend trip as a party, but without a mountain in sight this time.
So how did the weekend compare with your expectations?
It was much better than I'd expected. It made me change in subtle ways. As I'd hoped, I gained in self-knowledge and I learnt to get on with people I couldn't escape from. But I also became much more observant of the tiny little wild flowers, for instance. And that was quite a bonus.
Mm. I suppose you're going to be a regular mountain climber now.
The pair of boots I wore, I'm keeping with the mud still on them, on my desk at work. They're a kind of trophy to prove to myself that I've done it. But I somehow don't think I'll be using them again. I'm going to have to put them somewhere less visible, though, because it's sometimes a bit embarrassing when other people are impressed.
Douglas Turner, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That is the end of part four. There will now be a pause of 5 minutes for you to copy your answers onto the separate answer sheet. Be sure to follow the numbering of all the questions. I shall remind you when there is 1 minute left so that you are sure to finish in time. That is the end of the test. Please stop now. Your supervisor will now collect all the question papers and answer sheets.